we were actually in Ibiza, myself and the kids and the whole family, like celebrating the rugby life that's not finished and I'm going to be corporate now. And then out of the blue, another long story.
No, please tell us. So I was going to get there anyway.
The kids were sleeping and yeah, people think Ibiza is just party. There is a family side to the island as well. And anyway, so we're sitting, the kids are sleeping, and myself and my wife are sipping on some mojitos. All I want to do, like most men, when you've got kids, you just want to spend some quality time with the missus.
Yes.
And out of the blue, I get a text message from Rassi saying, listen, is your line up? Are you still available? And I'm like, I thought of Vincent Koch taking the mickey out of me. And this is late. It was late at night, so if you take the time difference, it was probably past 12, and I'm like thinking it's Vincent going, of course I'm ready, I'm the quickest, the most beautiful, the strongest, the fittest,
I haven't stopped training,
who can the world, but referring to something, some other profession, right? And extremely expensive. So anyway, so after like three text messages, the lawyer of my the type of personality my wife is, the lawyer type, she's, are you sure this is not Rassi Erasmus? Of course, phone it off to midnight. Hello, who's speaking? Hello, Scala Osras. This is, oh my goodness. Apologize. I must have sounded like the most arrogant rugby player ever after those couple of text matches.
So we've got Skalk Brits with us in the house. We're very fortunate this morning to have him with us. He did a bit of sports activity this morning, or some golf activity this morning with Arthur. But Skalk, there's a welcome, firstly.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite, guys. It's amazing being here.
And I just want to summarize one of the biggest reasons we have you here, humbleness.
Yes.
It's one of the things that follows your name all over and wherever you go. And we were just chatting about dads, you know, being present and a lot of stuff that a lot of young kids are dealing with today that necessarily wasn't so prevalent, you know, in earlier days. But I don't think it's a bad time for you that one of the things, and I want to ask you straight, and you must tell me, but you're such a great dad and a husband, but you're also a celebrity. You come from this massive world of sport. You have access to networks that not a lot of people have in this country. So you're almost that perfect guy to not be a good father and loyal to your family, raising the boys well. Because today it's normal if that's not the case. And there's no judging on the other side. But how do you get that right? And why is that an important mindset for you in your life?
I don't think you always get it right. For me, is like you rightly say, it's my prerogative to have a relationship with my boys, because I've had a great and still have a great relationship with my dad and or my parents. And from that perspective, it's a choice that I make. For me, I've got three boys, 10, 8, and 6, Christian, Hunter, and Luke. And it's been a challenge because I grew up.
I didn't want to mention them, but
But I grew up as the only child, and for me it's I don't have any reference of the brother and sister. My three boys are extremely competitive, extremely feisty, and for me, so sibling rivalry is something totally different. But in rugby terms, I mean, you have to have amazing wife to support you as a sports personality for the long times you're away. Like the World Cup year, I think in 8 months I only slept 15 days at home. So from that perspective, for mother, and I think that's probably the hardest job ever, to look after kids and try to work and do manage the house is extremely, extremely difficult. So from that perspective, I'm so grateful that Glenda, my wife, is so amazing from that perspective. And for me, going into corporate world, I thought I would be more at home. yes, I was probably more days at home, but you're more present on different things. Mm. You're more focused on an email that needs to be sent, a spreadsheet that needs to be done. So from you home, but you're not present. And so from that perspective, the corporate world, moving from rugby or sports person to the corporate world, it came with different challenges.
A massive shift.
And so from I went to one of my mentors that has done it before me, not a rugby player, but a corporate guy. And he says, Skala is now pretty much 71 and sort of one of the biggest listed companies in South Africa. And he says, Skala, there's two things that you can't do. And I'm like, what's that? What can't I do? Because in our world is always what you can do. And he goes, there's two things you can't outsource. It's being a dad, can't outsource that, and you can't outsource being a father to your kids. And if I look back at my career, I've been extremely successful from the one side, from a business perspective, corporate perspective, and I've been sort of a trailblazer in the corporate world. But it came at a price. And the price was my relationship with my boys. Now, at my age, I can't catch up. The only thing I can catch up now is with my grandkids. And it's actually miss a generation. So from that perspective, I mean, everyone's got their own ways and own goals and own ambitions. Mine is to find a right balance between being successful business-wise or corporate-wise, still having a great relationship with my boys, and definitely the most important person in my life is my wife. So if I can get that balance right, and you can't get the balance right all the time, unfortunately. That is just how it is. You try to, you go, it's always like this.
Can't tick all the boxes.
You can't tick all the boxes. And it's sometimes, I mean, I can remember my boys sitting me down 3 months ago. So I'm talking now a lot.
No,
three
please go
months ago, they put me down and they said, Dad, we need to speak to you. So I'm like, what? Okay. So I'm sitting your like this summary. On the couch. Yes, I'm summoned. All three of them are standing in front of me. I thought it's something like, so they've got a girlfriend or something happened at school or whatever. They go, Dad, we've made a decision. So I go, what decision have you guys made? No, you need to quit your job. I said, okay. So now I'm trying to figure out the process here. So they say, and I said, why? Like most things you ask, why? And they go, no, because you are way more now than you were when you played rugby. So I said, okay. So I said, okay, well, of course, in life, you need money to pay for things. How am I going to pay for things? I said, no, it's easy, Daddy. All you do is you go start playing rugby from next week. You phone the coach and say you're available again. I said, well, while I was playing, you were complaining that I was away too much. Now I'm doing corporate and I'm here at weekends. Now you say I'm away. So I can't win. I said, and one thing, boys, unfortunately, I'm 41. There isn't any rugby players that's 41 who's still playing. So that got shoved aside. But it gives you quite a reality check.
Mm. But, I mean, they've got some point of reference because you said, you know, about the traveling. You did that at 38, which was the World Cup in 2019. So do you think that was a little bit different for you at a stage where your family was sort of established versus a younger player in terms of the traveling? Because like the other day, I think it was Dwayne actually that had an interview where he was saying, you know, when you get to that his age, they don't want to go. When they get to a place, they deal with
jet lag.
And they don't just go out for a beer anymore. Where the youngsters, you know, they can still go out for a beer that same day when they land and be perfectly the next morning.
I think I was very fortunate, myself and Glenn had the kids quite late, 30-odd, 31. I was our first, when Christian was born. I think we were very fortunate to travel the world, see a lot of different places, live in England. And I was very fortunate to be at a rugby club called Saracens that changed my whole viewpoint on process, success, making memories. And the way they looked after us was just phenomenal. But their viewpoint was for every individual, three things to function. And there was someone to love, something to do and something to dream for, right? So they say, what's the most important thing at home if you've got a wife or a girlfriend? Happy, happy wife, happy life. So from that perspective, we never, almost never slept over. They would make sure that we, on the morning, we would fly back in the, at night time. Why? Because if your wife is happy, you can focus on the game, and there's a lot of different things. The only agreement they had with the wives, of course, the wives would love that. And they said, well, the night before, two nights before the game, please take the kids for two nights. But we'll make sure we're not going away from Monday and only you see your kid, your husband on a Sunday evening again.
It's a fair.
So it's a fair trade. And from that perspective, it changed a viewpoint. And then you come back to South Africa. And we weren't actually established here. I was, Galinda still works for a law firm in London. Cambridge was sorted, Rainet was sorted, my plan to work in England was sort of sorted. I retired June in 2018, we won the premiership, and everything was, we were actually in Ibiza, myself and the kids and the whole family, like celebrating the rugby life. It's not finished and I'm going to be corporate now. And then out of the blue, another long story.
No, please tell us. So I was going to get there anyway.
The kids were sleeping, and yeah, people think Ibiza is just party. There is a family side to the island as well. And anyway, so we're sitting, the kids are sleeping, and I'm sipping, myself and my wife are sipping on some mojitos. All I want to do, like most men, when you've got kids, you just want to spend some quality time with the missus.
Yes.
And out of the blue, I get a text message from Rassi saying, listen, is your line up? Are you still available? And I'm like, I thought of Vincent Koch taking the mickey out of me. And this is late. Was late at night. So if you take the time difference, it was probably past 12. And I'm like, thinking it's Vincent going, of course, I'm ready. I'm the quickest, the most beautiful, the strongest, the fittest.
I haven't stopped training.
Who can the world? But referring to something, some other profession, right? And extremely expensive. So anyway, so after like three text messages, the lawyer of my the type of personality my wife is, the lawyer type, she says, are you sure this is not Rassi Erasmus? Of course, phone it off to midnight. Hello, who's speaking? Hello, Skala Saras. Because it's, oh my goodness. I apologize. I must have sounded like the most arrogant rugby player ever after those couple of text matches. So literally from being in Ibiza, going back, then having a long conversation, because you have to have the commitment of your wife and your kids. Like my kids sat me down to tell me I'm going to start playing rugby again. I had to sit down and get the permission. So because it's a massive commitment and sacrifice.
Massive decision.
For me to go live my dream. I mean, it's easy for me to be on tour, seeing the world. Training is hard and being away from the family is hard, but it's they taking the knock. You know, they're not seeing dad for a very long time. I mean, I think we were in Japan for almost 3 months. So it's a long time for them to be without a dad, although FaceTime or technology has made it easier. It's just you can't replicate that, your personality through FaceTime. So anyway, so that's how I got back into the Springbok mix, and Rassi or the Springboks wanted me to live in South Africa. So while I was on tour, my wife packed up the house in England, moved the whole family over. And it was quite weird. So I was supposed to play a sign for.
So you were in. You were actively staying in England at the time.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So I was based in London or in St Albans, extremely happy. Kids were in school, and I was literally from, Glens, we need to move. The school finishes in September. Let's try to get the kids in October.
What month was this phone call?
This was in June. So I said...
And World Cup is in October,
So there was in 2018. October was 2019. So the thing was, then firstly I said to myself and Rachel had a discussion and said, listen, I'm taking sabbatical anyway for 3 months before work starts and my studying starts. I'll come for the June test matches against England. I know all the players and I felt at that stage... is that Jurassic was taking over. We were seventh in the world. We've had a record loss against New Zealand and Ireland. I thought, well, let's give back. Let's go try and help out. It's a couple of weeks. Galinda said it's fine. Anyway, so after we We had a great series against England. No one expected us to win. We won the first two matches, lost the last one at Newlands when we did a bit of a rotation, and then like things happened quite quickly after that. So I was going back thinking that I've done my part.
You also probably had to find a club to play for as well to get...
So that was the problem. So firstly, the first plan was for me to play for Cambridge and then just play international rugby, or do my studying, play rugby, university rugby, and then sort of that didn't work out from a Springbok perspective, because it's just a big performance gap, I would say, between the two. But then, I mean, Kalinda said, fine, it's 100%. Then I spoke to, of course, the kids and the family. Then I had to ask permission for Rainet, Johan Rupert. And from his perspective, he was amazing. He says, Skala, I mean, I've achieved a lot in the world, but, I mean, I've never become a Springbok. And he was so open-minded and said, Skala, go live your dream. What's the difference if you start working for Rainet at 37 or 38? It's just one more year, but just make sure that you're done after
exactly and win it
after that. And funny enough, he spoke to us that actually came to Japan, to Tokyo, and had a chat with the Springboks the week or the day before the final. So from that perspective, it was pretty amazing. So then I had to find a club back in South Africa. Eventually signed for the Stormers because that was my club. There was some...
I would have been super pissed if he moved to the Bulls, eh? Coming from a Stormers fan.
No, that's easy. Well, funny enough, so got the house, bought a house in Stellenbosch, moved the family over. We had a training camp just before I left to the Tri Nations, or now the...
Rugby Champs.
Rugby Championships, and got just a text message from the CEO back then and say, sorry, the deal has
gone through.
No, it hasn't gone through. There's some issues from that perspective. So I'm like, oh my goodness. Said no to all the clubs in the UK.
Moved your family.
I moved my family across, and that was a nightmare. So then luckily the Bulls sort of took me in under their wing, and it was actually... The way they treated me at the Bulls was, they'd been backwards for myself and Dwayne. So we flew up most weeks, Monday morning, the red eye flight at 6 o'clock. Then we were, Monday, Tuesday, flew back Tuesday after training, you know, then tried to do Wednesday at home, then Thursday back, and then Friday or Saturday home after the game. So they were very flexible to make it work from their perspective. And from then, I mean, it was just, then it's pretty much where I ended up at the Bulls and then played rugby. So that whole year, not just the World Cup year, but the year before that, it was a big sacrifice from everyone's perspective.
Two things there. What's it sort of behind the scenes in preparing for a World Cup? And we always speak about it, and this is now from a general consumer's rugby perspective. Yeah. We always find, and it's like Latin golf, when we spoke about Eric and Dave Usendorf and all of them, when you get to top 130, pretty much the skill is there for everybody. Everybody can hit a wonderful round of 62 on their best of days. But it's the mindset that separates the one to the other. And obviously also life circumstances. But what type of mindset does the Springboks create leading up to something like that? And Skalk, in the same breath, if you don't mind, what does it feel like being the captain and responsible for also playing or leading this team onto the field and making decisions as it? Because remember, all of us, we have this idea. We all played rugby at school. But when it comes to that level, it's all adults, it's much bigger men, there's a lot of things and emotions that run around, yeah. And then pride, and then you carry, all of a sudden, you know, from a Falkies, you carry a Falkies to the finals against an Uffies, but now all of a sudden you've got the entire country. And I mean, we know South African fans are different. What does that feel like?
I think it's quite different to every stage of your life. If I was 20 and you played for the Springboks, like Frans Sam when he won the first World Cup in 07, your prep changes from I guess 07 to 2019 for France. So you must understand this: the squad dynamics is different, the coach is different. I mean, the 2015 World Cup prep was quite different to Rassie's prep in 2019. And I guess the principle stays the same. I think things that does happen is you train unbelievably hard in preparation, because what does every coach want? He wants a very fit squad.
Yeah.
Right? So he makes sure that the whole team is as fit as possible.
Remember that photo, sorry to interrupt, where the whole squad stood in the change room with the shirts off and everyone looked like a can of corn. I say can of corn is torn. Just chiseled to the T. Those are athletes in that squad. Eh?
So that's why I took the picture, so I was the chisel. the thing is it's not just the World Cup. I think it's a lead up to it. I mean, this I can give credit to Rassie and to Jacques and the whole coaching squad. Is the way they prepared us before even the World Cup started was fantastic. Everyone knew their place. Everyone knew where the challenges might be. And the whole management squad, including the physios, everyone was committed. And there was a phrase that everyone said, everybody just stay in your lane, because I can't tell Andre how to kick. He can't tell me how to throw. And I can't tell the physio how to treat my injuries. She's qualified to do what Renee does, for example. So just let them be, and you just focus on your job. So from that perspective, mentality is a bit different. Yeah. I think the work we put in as players was clever, the way they made sure that we were fit. Normally, in the beginning of rugby, the fitness was done in a different way. They would just send you up and down without really much, thinking. Yeah. There was no analytical data behind it, right? So for a guy I can remember my first cats, this is not a long time ago, training camp, they let us do 35, 100s, but you have to come in under a certain time or else the 100 doesn't count. But that was the whole squad. Now for flanker, for example, wingers normally burn out because they're quick, but they can't repeat that. And unfortunately, the props can't run that because they just...
But they've got the endurance.
No, they just can't get there quick enough.
Okay,
so they can do the first couple.
Then so it never counts.
So it never counts. And then we started giving them from 22, but you just start running past them. Hey, I can't say anything about the props. They looked after me during my whole rugby career, because I was small, they were big, and they were scary. But just from a prep perspective, going into the 2019 World Cup, and every World Cup is different, as I said, but the big thing is actually get the principles right before you go to the World Cup, making sure the culture is right, making sure that the values in our team is right. Because if you don't have that in place and you come under pressure, like you said, from a performance perspective, because it's not just this small bubble that you live in. Yeah, I mean, social media has changed the whole way you get analyzed. In the olden days, there would be a Sunday newspaper saying how good or you're bad and you had a rating. Then your coach on Monday would give you a feedback on it.
Performance review.
So a feedback loop is quite quick. But now, I can remember being away in the darkness at Saracens, not playing for the Springboks from 09 till probably 2012. And we lost anyway. So I was sitting, we played Argentina, and I can remember this vividly, and I was sitting next to a guy that started. Most of the time I was on the bench anyway, or in the stands, but I was sitting next to this guy, and I'm not going to mention his name, and he was said to play a certain way, this specific game, kick it quite a lot, make sure that we play in the right areas, and he's quite an attacking player. And for me it was quite weird afterwards going sit next to him, and we lost our first test match against Argentina in Durban, and he goes, Scala, look at this. And the amount of abuse the guy got for kicking the ball or playing a certain style sort of made me give me a reality check on what actually the younger generation look at. Because, and that was my feedback. Listen, buddy, the public doesn't pick the squad, but yet the public has an influence on coaches, who they like or who they don't like, or who they should play and shouldn't play. So unfortunately, and that's where I think Rassie was amazing. He would say, listen, boys, I give you the blueprint to play against this team, but I want your input. So together we make plans to play certain teams. And sometimes, I mean, from their perspective or from the coach's perspective, sometimes they said, sorry, I stuffed up. I'm sorry. And the team meeting as well. And as a player, it's quite nice that a coach shows vulnerability, shows his fails. And from a player's perspective, you can say, Russ, oh my goodness, I'm sorry. I had a bad throw-in or I had a bad day at the office. And if you look at, for example, Vili during the 2019 World Cup, he went through a bit of a purple patch during that World Cup. But everyone goes through it. But just by Russie actually showing the players during one of the team meetings, what Vili does off the ball. When people watch rugby and they just see the guy that scores a try or makes a break, they don't see how people close down space or do different things.
Opportunities.
Or create opportunities. And people don't even know that Vili had a fractured... Peter Steph Tatoi sort of slided into him. And people didn't know his scapula was at a fracture. And actually, Dion was one of the guys that sorted out Vili's injury, but we only knew afterwards that he had the fracture. And if you've got a fracture in your shoulder blade, you can't get your one hand up high enough. But yet, and the final, he was phenomenal, and it was it was great. But I mean, you can, on a prep perspective, the one thing that I would say that people sometimes lose when it becomes professional, and that's different to school or to when you play with your mates, is the enjoyment factor. And the one thing that you should never lose is a passion for the game. And sometimes, it goes high, and sometimes when you play, like, golf, especially me, sometimes I play crap, and you're like, how can this be so frustrating? But I guess the big thing is you're fortunate to be on the pitch with mates, and you're there to actually, you get paid to do it. I started playing rugby not because I'm going to get paid or I'm going to get paid in the future. I played it because I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that I always try to remember if I play the game, is always the enjoyment factor. And it comes actually way back from experience that I had with my dad. And I was playing for Paris under 15. We lost the game. And I was so fed up and negative. And my dad sat in the car driving back and he goes, why are you so unhappy? I'm like, Dad, I played so badly. It was just a crappy day. I don't want to play rugby anymore. And he goes, well, okay, then don't play. Because if you're this unhappy, then I don't want you to play this game. You can do whatever. You go bodyboarding or surfing from Osaban. It sort of gave me a reality check, is to say, irrelevant what the outcome might be of the results. But while you're in this battle of the game and you're fighting good or bad, when you're playing well or badly, it's still... you're fortunate to be in this game. And that sort of changed my mindset towards all sports. Although sometimes with golf, especially golf, then it struggles. But just remember, sometimes I played golf last week and I played average. And the guy just said, well, it's better than sitting in front of the desk. And it's a small nugget, but it's you must remember that.
Skog, it's so interesting what you said there about the change and the way that Rassie, and I suppose in a modern time today, you guys all felt like you had a stake in the plan. And in corporate, I suppose also today, it's a far more, Formula One, which I also follow, it's now not just the guy rocks up for training. They switch the car and they say, go for it. He has an involvement in the brakes and the development of it and how it feels. And they custom the car. Every car gets custom to that particular driver. And now that I sit here on the perspective, I never really knew that inside of how Rassie was approaching it. But it makes completely sense even from a corporate perspective. You can't be dictatorial. You have to be more inclusive. You have to people that are specializing in what they do to get their opinion, so that that plan or whatever we're creating is an inclusive plan that everybody is driving towards with an end result.
Yeah, no, it's definitely like, and it starts actually from training perspective, back way back when I started the game. As I said, they just let you do fitness. Now, when I moved to Saracens, they were one of the first teams to put a GPS thing on your back, a heart rate monitor in the front.
And that's for data.
And they we played with these concussion monitors to make sure what kind of contact, because they were scared they might get sued in the future. And it was all about player safety.
Okay.
So they were very forethinking on player welfare, making sure everything is all right. But then from a strategic and statistical perspective, everyone is built differently. I mean, of genetic makeup is different. So to make sure that everyone is on the same level, they said, we're going to make fitness fun, but it's going to be hard. But it's your input that is going to be measured. So I'm like, okay, fine. So in the gym, they put certain monitors on. So you literally go to your iPad, tap on your name, bench press, and they put monitors that measures your output. So they can see everything. Same with the fitness. We play games to make it fun for players. No one wants to do fitness just without a ball. Fitness is there. If you can correlate it with rugby, it's a double whammy kind of thing with a ball. So they made... Sure, I could say, this is your target before the training session. This is the amount of meters I want you to run. This is the amount of heart rate minutes above 85 we want.
Specifically to you?
All individualized.
Okay.
Nothing, because the world has moved just like golf.
And just a swing. The swing isn't the same for everybody. Coaching seems to be almost standard in certain places. Are you exactly what you're saying?
So, for example, it's silly to think that they're going to, why should I go to any place and get a set of golf clubs that is generic for everyone, because I'm different to you and you. Why should I go and buy a set of golf clubs that isn't actually fitted for me? So you can take it same to rugby. They said, well, this guy's a bit bigger, weighs 120. His max heart rate is, for example, my max heart rate is 183. So in the beginning, they thought I was sitting on my ass the whole time, not pushing hard enough. But when they know my max heart rate is 183 and I run at 165, that's almost as close I can get to my heart rate in those fitness sessions. I was covering a lot of meters. So they would say, like, what's the thing? Different horses for courses kind of thing. That was sort of their outlook. So, and then the good side or the good and bad side. So if you do if your targets are set beforehand, so there's no illusion between perception and reality, the target is there. And then they would say, okay, fine, if you reach it, everyone goes, play the games. When you're done, everyone wants to the iPad or the screen, and they show, okay, good, 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 sorry, you didn't work hard enough, fitness. Good, 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 bad, fitness. So then you knew as a player, if you didn't reach those targets, you are doing fitness afterwards that isn't as pleasant.
So you're probably just going to go run laps.
No, we did up and down. So you do up 22 or 5 meters back, 22 back, 10 back. And so you repeat that a lot of times. Or they had different kind of things that they made it. But the games were pleasant. So you wanted to keep. And the thing is, one of the things, input from the players is, nobody likes just to run. I'm not an athlete from a... how do you say
athleticism,
athlete. I'm a rugby player, so
I'm not a runner.
So from that perspective, and a lot of the bigger guys at 120 kilograms, you're not really a runner. So do something that's rugby related, but the other part wasn't so great when you do that. Sorry, it's a lot.
No, not at all. We spoke a little bit about entitlement.
Yeah,
because nowadays, you know, I know for a fact that. For you to go into the corporate world, you did a lot of studying as well.
Yeah.
And again, Skalky, I'm just coming from the perspective, you Skalk Brits, and hear me out, and everybody would understand when I say that why should you? You should be able to get a job quite easily that pays you well. You should be quite well-sponsored by brands and etc. purely because of the nature of the beast. But you put so much effort into your own life. You study. And it feels to me like you don't have an attitude of the world owns me anything. And why must somebody like you, with your stature, with everything that you've achieved in your life, and I think that raising your family and being a great husband is one of that great achievements, why are you so humble in that approach and just talk. It feels entitlement is a big thing at the moment in the world that we live in.
Firstly, let's first speak about myself. Oh, that sounds quite. And then I'll come back. So I'll bring it back to the entitlement part, and then I can bring it back to actually to one of the things that we did at the World Cup. Firstly, from my perspective, I think it's definitely a way you raised that can surely make an impact on that. My dad was one of those that if I didn't play enough, he would tell me I wasn't good enough on the day, but be more specific, but in a loving way.
Yeah.
Like it's not always the ref, it's not always the coach. He would say, always say, first look at yourself.
So because like from a mental point of view?
From a mental perspective, he would say, did you try your best? Were you physical enough? Or whatever it might be, did you train hard enough? Mm. So he's always like, I did a lot of sports when I was younger and I was quite okay with a lot of it. But he was like, I can remember under 11 doing essays and so trained not hard enough. And Dad was like, he did warn me once or twice, but he's the type of set to give me my own responsibility. The same, I had my own responsibility when I wanted to go from Marcel Bay to pole race, and he went like, my son, it's your decision. I'll back you with that, but just know there comes a responsibility. You're away from home, you're away from us. We will like you to go to school, yeah, but if you're ambitious and you want to go to that school, it's fine, but then you need to graft. So that's one viewpoint that he's got that sort of installed sort of
discipline.
A discipline, and life is not fair, and life doesn't owe me anything. So there's no reason why I have to be entitled on things. And then secondly, trying to treat everyone the same as, once again, from a parent's perspective, but I had a sort of a euro. I guess everyone's got a euro when they're younger. And I was at Newlands, and this guy was like, I would literally kiss his boots or polish his boots or whatever. And it was really extremely rude when I sort of tried to meet him. And I was like, oh my goodness, this guy isn't as nice as I thought he was. But to his own, probably to his own accord, he was just after a game. He was probably tired.
Or a bad moment.
So I don't. And actually, I've met him after that, but they say never actually meet your heroes. But actually, and he wasn't that unpleasant when the second time I met him, but that was years later when he wasn't a rugby player anymore. And we were driving back in the car, and I'm like, I'm ever going to be a hero, or I don't ever want to have another hero. And he was like, well, Dad's viewpoint was be your own hero then. So from that perspective, Mom and Dad giving me advice and sort of from that perspective, and it just comes down to your value as a human being isn't by your achievements, but it's how you treat people. And for me, that's how I'm trying to treat a CEO, a rich, a poor,
an author.
Everyone the same, because it must be extremely exhausting to be one type of person in front of someone and then someone else in front of another person. It's just, from a corporate perspective, I don't understand it, why. It just blows my mind that you would treat people differently just because of their stature or their bank balance or the car they drive or whatever. So from that mentality, I try to treat everyone always the same. And then lastly, on the new generation or the younger generation X or whatever you can call it, or the millennials. Yes.
Z, Y, F, and B, A.
But you must understand from their background, they are just grown up in a different environment where you are told you are great, you are fantastic, you get a medal even if you come 12th or 15th or
last.
But for me, it takes the guy that comes last and get a medal, it's great for participation, but you can thank that person for participating. But to go so far to give someone a medal, it invalidates the one that's actually worked incredibly hard to come first, second, or third, or whatever it might be, because then you, that's just my personal opinion. So from that perspective, you must understand that perspective from the new generation, because that is always seen as, well, if I've taken part, I have to get something. I have to get a reward, and I don't think it's always the case. You get a reward when you are good at something. You get the reward
in the real world. It works that way.
Yeah, if you take part, you being healthy, you getting better health. You meet new people. You learn how to socialize. So from that perspective, and then bring it back to 2019 World Cup, I think that was the biggest thing we focused on, is entitlement, because you are not guaranteed a spot. You don't deserve that Springbok shirt. That shirt is something that is given for you to represent our country, that number, the generations of number twos or hookers before me. And I will pass that shirt on, hopefully in a better place going forward. So I don't deserve that shirt. It's an honor for me to wear that shirt.
A time and a place.
Yeah. So I'm just a carrier of that. And that is sort of the big thing that we try to make sure. And the other part from a Springbok perspective is the same thing. We are in South Africa. We're very fortunate to have a great team, but we've got a very passionate
nation
and supporters. Yes. And they demand results, right? But the one thing is, from a social perspective, you are being put on a pedestal.
Yeah.
You are
massively
are become influencer, or you become important very early on. You're getting paid very well early on, and you are loved by things that's external, and that can have, and me personally, sometimes you get too big for your shoes. That is factually the case, because everyone tells you how pretty and how good and all those kind of things, but in reality you're never as crap as they say, and you're never as good as they say either. So from that perspective, is sometimes if you've got good friends, and that's advice that I got, is keep your friends, remember your roots. That is big things, having friends from school, having friends from university. And I was fortunate to have that. And they would cut me down quite quickly. They know the scholar, not the rugby player.
Mm.
They would say, scholar, get back in your box, or opwind gaat wees. So from that perspective, to have that sort of guy keeping me humble, I would say it's very valuable. And then with the Springbok, taken back to them. So you must first understand that, where the millennials come from, or all the generations come from. But you must be willing to listen as well, because I've got a different viewpoint than my dad. My son will have a different point to me. I mean, Damon Willemse was born in 99 and I was in grade 12 in 99. So his viewpoint is just a bit different to mine, although from a cultural perspective, and or not cultural, from a principal perspective, we should have the same values.
Yeah. I just want to say, was it quite extra special for you that at that particular time, I did not know this, but Paul Roos has developed the most Springboks in any school. Paul Roos is number one, 54 Springboks as of 2021.
Yeah.
Plus, it was also the biggest squad from one school in the World Cup at that particular time.
Yeah.
Was that extra special for you guys? Was it very generational differences in times that you were at that school? And was there a little bit of banter between you guys and the rest of the squad at that time?
I would say in 2019, no, there wasn't a lot of banter on different schools, but there's always banter. I mean, I can, Scala and John and Paul Jim, would always have,
I was just going to say, because I saw your interview with De Villiers,
John,
and I mean, it just in that moment where you guys swapped jerseys or came out with where you started, it's amazing. And I saw that was not scripted. They just started chirping immediately. Like, look at you, you're much bigger. Look at you, you're much smaller.
Yeah, so there's always banter from a school perspective. But I think the diversity of schools has increased.
Yeah.
Of different, I mean, Yibin, he was a no name, well, I can't say no name, not a very popular rugby school.
Yeah.
But from that perspective, it was a very proud moment, and it was across different generations of Borussians that went to the World Cup. But I'm actually, we had our interschools a couple of weeks ago, and it was actually, rugby was a big part, but it's actually, it was amazing to see that the success we've got, not just from a rugby perspective, because rugby is great, but it's just a sport.
Yeah.
But the main aim of any school is to raise great people.
Yeah.
And great kids, and give them the skill set to take on a very difficult life with a lot of different challenges. And rugby is only a small part of that part. It brings good friendships. Sport does have the power to change, but change in a way of giving people hope, bringing friendships together, but on a skill set base. And it gives you skills as well to work with people. But from a school perspective, I'm proud to see, like, the hockey was great. The debate was good. We lost the table tennis. The chess was fantastic. I mean, there's so many dynamics. And if you can find, in every school, it must suit everyone. Like, everyone must find their own niche. I was a rugby player. There was a guy that was a singer, Jacobus Brink. He was in the band. So there was a great band. There's guys that played hockey. There was other guys that... And for me, it's amazing when I was speaking to, Frans van Niekerk, he was saying, well, out of the 200 kids, there was an average of more than 100 A's. So that is things that is actually more valuable to make sure the kids are happy. Secondly, that they've got the skill set to take on the world, that they're principle-based and good people. And then I'm pretty much, and if you put rugby on top of that, that's even better.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned it, and it comes down a little bit to your personality as well. So I think I'm a little bit more like Eben, you know, coming out of Falkies and etc. It certainly doesn't have that rich cultural history.
If I might ask, where's Falkies?
It's the Potch one. It's even worse. It's the Potch one.
It's not Falks, right?
But you can easily sitting, and it's always perception. So yeah. You could easily sit on the side and say Skalks had a very privileged life, and I think you would recognize that yourself. Yes, no doubt about that. But the reason you're sitting here, and the reason we try and do this show as well, is that is just the reality of your life. You went to a great school, a school with great history, obviously in an area that's surrounded with a lot of benefits and access and etc. But what I like the most about it is that the way that you've approached it is that it is also time now to give back. Yeah. And what I see a lot in the players at the moment is we are normalizing normal. And I see that from the highest point. And I'll give you an example. When somebody says to me, you know, what do you do? And they're like, I'm a plumber. I'm like, what do you mean you're a plumber? You're a plumber. That's incredible skill to have. Do you know that you are more in demand in the world than an attorney and in certain cases a doctor? Do you know that skill you can take here and multiply that anywhere in the world and provide for your family? We mustn't see it as I'm a plumber. It's an incredible thing to do, and what a pride moment for you to carry that. You know, I'm a teacher, or I was raised by a mom that's a teacher. And, you know, anybody that would see my mom, she would probably just think, you know, oh, just a teacher. But if you know what influence she has on the kids that she was there, while she was there, the sufferings or the sacrifices that she needed to make, I want to honor those people. And you do a lot of that in the past life or coming out of that world. And is that important to you? And how do you get past the – how do we inspire kids in schools that don't have that access? And I know that you're involved in a lot of programs that help and support that. I mean, none of the ambassadors you are was just amazing to me. £150 million that was put into sports development for kids that don't have the access necessarily that you perhaps had.
Yeah.
Have I got it wrong, Skalk, or do you think there's a message in that?
No, I think if you can start looking at people firstly from a different pair of glasses, and that was quite a perception that was installed in South Africa, where you need to go study. While you study, you need to be a doctor, a lawyer. My wife's a lawyer. I did accountancy. Or what it might be that is seen as a well-paying job. Then you go across to England, where I lived for 10 years, and there it was totally different. You would sit in the pub with all walks of life.
Yeah.
and your value wasn't determined by the car, because there you had to walk to the pub. The houses were small. You had investment bankers from the city. You had, like you said, the gardener, the plumber, the doctor, everyone sitting there and having a beer together. And your value there then was by the type of person you are, not by the house or the car or the...
Do you want to be around? Do they want you around?
Do they want you around or not? I can't use the language, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. So
you're a doers.
That is pretty much...
Good summary, Alfie.
I heard in a very nice way by, say... probably I can't say that, but they say, and the first time ever this phrase, see you next Tuesday type of guy.
Yeah.
So they said, is he see you next Tuesday type of guy? And yeah. I'm like, I've got no idea what that means, but okay, then they explain. So from that perspective, it's understanding that what I said this previously, your value as a human being isn't by what is in a bank account or what car you drive is, but actually how you treat people and all people. And then getting back to the other things about giving, I mean, I've been through my life involved with different foundations, but it's actually every time I'm involved with anything, I actually get more out of it than I actually put in, because it's a lot nicer giving than receiving, right? So from that perspective, if you go to... Laurie's got a lot of these outreaches to any of these programs, you actually have a bit of a reality check, and you say, I've been raised fortunate. I definitely have been raised in a very fortunate position to be where I am today, and then try to go back to and get perception on hardships of people that have to walk a long way just to get fresh water, to go to places where they need to relieve themselves. And it is, and the focus has always never been adults, really. It's always been kids, because I saw in my lifetime what impact sport can have, where they can just forget for an hour and a half of all their troubles, get one good meal. And Laureus or Coolplay, there is a lot of organizations out there, but I would, we're not in South Africa as much involved with things like in the UK, but I think we've got our own challenges. Don't want to get into too much political stuff, but challenging our country from that perspective. But it's, for anyone that thinks about getting involved in any charitable work, if you've got time, you get more out of it than you actually put in, because you actually get a reality check every time I go into places that I don't often go into. I go, wow, I'm fortunate and I'm very lucky to be where I am. But then what can I help? How can I inspire the next generation? Because I'm going to be I'm already an old toppy, but the younger generation is going to look after us in a different way. So
let's talk a bit about golf, Skalky. I think firstly, when you have a personality like you on the show, that's got a history like that in sport that we all appreciate, you have to go into that first.
Yeah.
Everybody would be pissed off if we didn't.
Yeah.
But now, let's talk a little bit about golf.
Yeah.
The first time I played golf with you, I must be honest, I was hoping you quite shit. But reality came, and you weren't just a good golfer, like a single digit or 4 or 5 handicapper. You were an exceptionally skilled golfer, and you still are to this day. And somebody that I even thought to myself, me and Henry spoke about it when we left. We were like, you can basically play the Sunshine Tour, and that's down to the athleticism. But you are an incredibly good golfer. So when did golf, and I'm assuming golf started quite early, and I know that you guys bond a lot over golf between you and your mates.
Yeah.
If it's, and I know that fan court is also a big part of your life.
Yeah.
And I know that you just recently moved to, you bought a house in
Stellenbosch.
Stellenbosch. Mm. But so golf, when did that come in? Why are you so passionate about it? And when do you get time to train? Because you also now not a rugby player anymore. So I also have a work, Scala. How do I not get better in golf, and how do you do that? Is that that extra dedication that you do in the morning? How did you get here?
No, so golf-wise, is actually just fell into it. I was probably pretty much 11, 12 years old. I'm left-handed, right? So there wasn't left-handed clubs. my dad had didn't play golf. My granddad had golf clubs. That was 1960, and just started picking up the game, like most kids do. There was a random golf set. I took it, started playing golf, although it felt so awkward being left-handed, batting left, doing everything left, playing right-handed golf. And funny enough, there was an age, I actually just really started picking up golf at 15, roundabouts, that I became very passionate about this unbelievable game, because firstly, you can do it with friends. At that stage, it wasn't that expensive. Dad was picking up the ball. Oh. And it was like 10 rand around at Stellenbosch Golf Club. It was extremely cheap for as scholars. And it's time that you can spend with friends. And for me, it was a game that, I guess with most games, but this was quite unique for me, as it is you and the elements and a ball that is standing still. And I can't, it still breaks my mind that I can't have the power over the ball for extended period. You might have one great shot and then three average shots and then one great again. And you can't blame anyone else. In team sports, you rely on your mates or your teammates to help you in a bad day, or on a good day, you're on a roll and kind of thing. And to that extent, golf is similar, but I can't blame anyone. And it's just you. And the biggest thing that for me that makes golf so amazing is the battle that goes up between the ears. Mm. Where for everyone's had, for example, a snap or a draw or fade, and how you mentally sort of compromise in your head and aim left to make sure it goes right, but that's just clever. But so from that perspective, the game is for me fascinating. Of course, and guys like Ernie Els, Louis Oosthuizen, and you know, they were quite inspirational at a young age. I was lucky enough to meet Ernie when I was very young, and myself and Louis come from Mossel Bay, so I knew him from a young age. So, from school days. So it's quite nice if you meet guys that is in the game, that are fantastic what they do, and this game is just, for me personally, the best game in the world. And then you can always put a wager on something, make it more competitive, and it gets the juice is flowing. So I love this game. That's pretty much. And now, funny enough, my wife eventually took up golf.
I was just going to ask you, your whole family's playing.
At the age of 40. And I've got and all three boys are starting to play golf. So for me, it's in the beginning, it was me and my mates and my dad. It's one way that still today, myself and my dad plays a lot. And now sort of a skill set you giving to your kids and your wife. And it's, I can tell it, all males is out there, I know it's a male dominated game.
I was just going to ask you, Skylar, that's a dangerous place there with a wife to bring it in. Some men would have argued with you on that one.
Yes, like, I mean, I'm getting a lot
of... So give us some hope, yeah.
I'm getting a lot of grief from my Stellenbosch friends saying, why the hell would you ever let your wife play golf, right?
We were taught that's a no-go.
That is a sort of a no-go. It's on a boys' weekend, you just take a wife with. But for me, it was quite interesting. I'm getting less grief because, you know, we play together Sundays. Some days she doesn't want to even invite me for a round of golf. She her own friends. So yeah. It's quite amazing. And then as a family unit, and that's one of the things why I love FanQuad. It's not just for the golf. People just see it as a golf destination, but it's actually one of the best destinations, period. Because you've got the swimming, you've got the tennis, you've got the
running. Late night pool. I mean, I'm a big fan of that late night spa facilities at the bottom.
No, it's amazing. It is, and everything there works, and And like in your younger days, your happy wife, a happy life, now it becomes sort of the same thing as when the kids are happy, your wife is then happy, then you are happy.
Are you saying you're actually starting the right trend from here? And from here on, it's bring more wives into it. It will be more enjoyable for all of us. Yeah. You can allow to play more golf.
He's actually clever because now his wife's involved. Now they can go to fan court and she's got something to do and whatnot. It's not like going to the sea and sitting at the beach. So she's actually drawing her in so that you can actually enjoy the pleasures himself. You know?
Yeah.
The question is, how can I help you to help me?
Exactly. I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Okay, so Stella, we're listening.
And the funniest part is, like, she, before we had kids, she would actually walk with, she didn't do it often or get in the car just to get some fitness. And she always went,
how?
How can you get so upset about a game of golf? You can't believe you use that swear word. I'm like, Glenda, you don't understand. There's nothing as frustrating as hitting a new Pro V into the water.
Yeah.
It's a brand. It's like a
Big Mac meal. There's a meme about it. Yeah. There's memes about this stuff.
Yeah, it's like a Big Mac meal in the water. There it goes. Anyway, so we go on this office golf trip, and she hits like three tops in a row, and my wife does not there. Never ever, well, she never swears. I've got some what's onkruid? What do you call it?
Ach, my genade.
Onkruid is like weed in my garden. Like
language
weed in my garden. Anyway, so she goes, she hits three shots.
No?
That is like doop, doop, doop. And she goes, fuck, 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 fuck. And I fell to the floor laughing. And she says, what? I says, see, golf is frustrating.
Yes.
So that's pretty much, yeah.
And Scala, now, are you guys, is she enjoying it? Did she not just get into it? Is she enjoying golf now? It's now part of her life.
Yeah, it's definitely, we're playing more often. We're taking the boys a lot in Stellenbosch and Paul Valley and DeZolza. We are so blessed in this country.
Yeah, to have access.
Unbelievable golf courses.
Yeah.
And they are... They know that's the future. A lot of the clubs, unfortunately, got, I would say, when I got into golf, it felt just like an old man's game. I think now there's a lot of programs, especially where I live. I can't speak in Joburg, but they try to bring as many kids involved. You know, it's not just then about just playing golf. It's like throwing frisbees, throwing balls in the bunker, all things, and then there's a community afterwards where you have pizzas at the golf club, and from that perspective, if the kids are welcome, it will bring the parents there, and the kids sort of push you in a way, Dad, can we go play golf?
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, I want any excuse to play, but it's from that perspective, it makes it a lot easier to get the whole family involved, and we now very passionate about golf. Every boy's got their own clubs. Glinda's got her own clubs. And of course, there's always the debate, well, when I'm getting new clubs or when are you getting new clubs, and my boys are stealing my golf balls, sure, that I'm getting so frustrated with. So, yeah, you can use a Pinnacle. You don't need
a Pro V.
No. I want the Pinnacle. I said, I want the Pro V. I said, my boy, no.
Until you buy your own Pro V, you're going to be Pinnacle.
They actually, they sneakily go into my golf bag, and not just my kids, my missus as well. I mean, I bought her three boxes of golf balls, thinking she's going to play with that. And it's like, I just see that my balls are getting a lot less without me knowing. But anyway,
it's going to be padlock now for your golf bag.
Might be different generations, but that's the same for all of us. I also stole my dad's balls and made sure I also used all these brand new clubs that he was so passionate about. But it's the vehicle, yes, is golf. But we spoke to OG and Arthur and I the other day. So, when somebody says golf, you know, the first thing you might think is like, it's a privileged game. You know, why would I? But in Soweto, it was like a dumping site. So Rilani Mabasa Foundation and OG, they identified this place and they opened it up and it became a driving range. And then they put a container on there for education and access to internet with books and etc. immediately the community felt immediately an upliftment in the immediate area. But also it was something for the kids to go and do in the afternoon instead of, you know, coming up with all sorts of stuff and naughtiness and whatever you want to call it. Then from there, people come and speak to them like you, where it inspires them and they can't believe those people take the time to come there. Yes, the vehicle is golf, but sport and how that brings a community together, uplifts your community, is really what we are after behind it. And that's amazing what golf does in that environment.
Yeah, it's amazing. What golf has done in this country for a very small golf playing population.
Nation, yeah.
We've had amazing success. And sorry to bring it back to more just in general in sport, is sport has the power to change. And I mean, if Nelson Mandela says that,
yeah,
and that's why himself and Johan Rupert started the Laureus Foundation, because they saw what sport can do in 95. And my experience of what it did in 2019 or in 2007 is unbelievable going through.
1995, it was, you would say it was one of the biggest miracles we had.
Yeah, I mean, it's, for me, just running through the town or with everyone celebrating and seeing this on 2019 going on topless bus, where you go through townships and you run and you see, irrelevant of religion, yeah, background, yeah, race, everyone coming together and just supporting one cause and one team, and people hugging and loving and smiling, and it's just that I never thought it can have that impact till I saw it with my own eyes. I mean, arriving at Oliver Tambo and looking up and there's thousands and thousands of people, and not, once again, I'm going to say, reiterate this, it wasn't from one specific, it was South Africa. And we are known as the Rainbow Nation. That's why, for me, it's I see what the power of sport can do. And golf is one of those vehicles, like you said, that gives the opportunity for the guy that isn't as talented, for example, in rugby, or doesn't have the exposure to rugby, but you get the exposure to golf. And hopefully in future, with all the programs, there will be a lot more stories like Soweto to make sure that you get more players involved. And I think the South African Golf Federation is on a path of exploring and giving more opportunity to more players. I know Johan and Rembo is very passionate about it.
It's, you know, what's funny, and when I started boxing when I was younger, you take two naughty guys off the street, put them into a boxing academy, they come out completely different men. And what's amazing is they might go in with the idea that I'm using my fist to carve my way in life, and they come out never to raise your fist for any situation in any environment. Yeah. And that's the beautiful part about sport. And it's, you know, always when I say, because maybe, Scala, because I don't come from that world, I never want to make it an exclusive elitist type of idea, because it's not necessarily the sport around it, but it's the ability, that discipline that comes with it. And also the golfing community. When a golfer's clubs get stolen from Oratamba to Cape Town, or it's amazing. Everybody comes together. Everybody pulls together in order to make sure that that person is right and can play the tournament and can take it on. I know of wonderful stories on the tour that happens between this guy and Arthur. You would know that more than anything else, of how people are helping each other to carve their path and their way a little bit in life. Because golf is not actually the expensive part in that journey. It's the traveling.
Mm.
Am I right, Arthur?
Yeah, it's the traveling. It's the accommodation,
yeah,
the food. It's tough. It's a hard road, because you're playing against so many other people. I mean, it's, some tournaments is 140 guys, and you know, you need to make money in the top 10 to actually survive. The other guys from 20 to 40 just scrape by on expenses, talking about the local tour. So, but it's a great tour to get onto other platforms, other tours and whatnot. But it's a grind. I know guys, like we've discussed this before, staying in coaches, garages, sleeping in cars, sleeping in locker rooms, you know, not having places to stay, staying with family, friends, or, you know. So it's a hard journey, but it's a humbling journey because it brings you down to earth, if you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And the passion for the game is there. So it's really, really cool. I think golf does bring a lot of responsibility, a lot of discipline, as other sports do. But it's tough to get to the top, and you learn a lot, you know. So
we had Mike De Jong here the other day. I don't know if you know who Mike De Jong is, but he plays this incredible role in sport. I mean, his history is in tennis and the global role he played for that. But he's sort of Christian Maas is under his, you know, to help him with his mindset. And Casey Jarvis, there's a Eric van Rooyen. Christian Besaidenhout is also under his. And it's incredible the role that he plays in sport and that transition into it. Yeah. And that mindset that you have to have. Because when you play golf the way that you do, and on the level that you do, is a lot of your sports history and your mindset that under pressure shots, because I've seen you under two shots, particularly that I can remember. I don't think you know. I thought you were under pressure. But there was two shots and you kept your pressure very well. Was sport a big part of that? Did that help you with that mindset? Because do you agree that in golf, the skill set is relatively there for a lot of people? It's the ability to do it on the course, on the day, and on the moment.
Yeah, I guess, firstly, I just want to say I'm not the best golfer, but I enjoy the game. But
what's your handicap at the moment?
I think
what are your handicaps, Scott?
I can relate. I can
Scott,
relate.
What is your, answer Scott, that. What is your handicap at the moment?
It's all right.
Is it a plus?
No, it's not a plus. So let's just go back to the things I try to take away from rugby to golf. So, and that's actually, I use golf in my throwing in process when I played rugby, because as soon as you start, like, especially with all sports, what is everyone saying when you enter in any kind of sport? You have to win. Right? So by saying you have to win, you put undue pressure on yourself. That isn't actually, like, pressure is something that you apply on yourself most of the time, especially on golf as well. So I try to use is trying to focus on the process. So if I get the process right of from measuring the distance, looking at the layout of the hole, going, okay, fine, how do I get there? So that's the process to getting to the hole. And then whatever shots I want to execute in that specific goal, I try to focus just on the process. And if I hit the ball in the bush, that's fine, but I committed to the shot. I only get pissed off when I don't commit to the specific shot or shape, or change it, like, I guess most golfers, like a putt. You see its right lip, you stand over, it doesn't really feel right lip, and you hit it straight. And that's from that perspective. Then I get extremely annoyed with myself, because that's the one thing that you can control between your 2 years. Make sure your process is right, actually the result doesn't matter. If you commit to it, some putts will fall, some won't. I'm not Tiger Woods or any else, or now Rory McIlroy.
Yeah.
The one other thing is, I got extremely upset, and sometimes I still do, about golf, but the lesson I should have learned, or still learning, is I can't expect results if I don't put the hard yards in. So I can't think I'm going to play under par by playing once a week or once every 2 weeks or never hit balls. I mean, that's just the reality. And sometimes you must lower your expectation. If you don't train, you're going to play badly, or you're not going to play as good as you think you should. But that's where ego comes in the way, I guess.
Arthur and I speak about it all the time. We're saying you see Oaks just hack away on the driving range. And I think a shift in golf needs to come where rather go hit 15 balls with some purpose than hitting 100 balls. Literally all you get out of it is that you're out of breath afterwards.
Mm.
Because when it comes onto the course, none of those shots. And I'm telling you now, even a weekend ago, I played in the PGA professional day. Even on that field, you would hear the amateurs like, oh, my driving range session was so spot on. You know, and I say to the guy the other, I was like, listen, you have to understand when you say that, You justify whatever is going on in your golf on the moment. We all know that. We all amateurs golf. We all understand the striking you do on the driving range when it comes to the actual course. That's why on-course coaching is becoming very popular amongst golfers, so that you can transition that.
Yeah, well, not from your playing partners. That's a nightmare normally.
But what I'm
guilty of it as well, because there's a time constraint, right? So
yes.
If you go to the driving range, there's normally no purpose. Mm-hmm. The purpose of you going to the driving range is to get better.
Yes.
But golf is, the swing is complex, you can make it as complex or as simple as you want to. But you go to the driving range and you just go whack away, like you said. But that's my discussion with Kalinda, saying, Lovey, you're taking up golf. Start it right. Not like me. You can make small tweaks, but I've got years of habits that I need to change to get where you are. You starting from a fresh canvas, get a coach. See them once or twice in the beginning of the week. And she is seeing a coach, actually, that can help her.
Is get Murray, the foundations. Is Murray coaching?
Murray's looking after
her. He's a wonderful bloke.
So helping Kalinda with the foundations. And then from there on, in the beginning you have to see him a lot, and then later you see him once every two weeks or once every week or whatever it might be. And that's, I think, I'm guilty sometimes of it, because you think you're okay and you're working on things and you watch YouTube and you think, okay, I'm going to try this, or maybe this club is the answer.
This is the one.
We all want this magical fix.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's scary. I think a lot of guys practice without a purpose when they go to the range, as you were saying. You should, when you're driving to the range, have a purpose and say, right, okay, it's been windy for the last month. Let me go practice my punch shots today. Go play some different punches. Go play a low draw and a low fade and your stock, straight punch shot, and then, spice it up. Play some high draws, high fades. Picture yourself being on a golf course. I'm standing on number 10 at this hole. Let me stop, place a target on the fairway and go hit some fairways. Driving ranges are massive. I was also, sometimes when I was playing on tour, you have this guilty conscience, like, okay, I need to go practice this weekend. This week wasn't as good as what it should be from a practice perspective, because I played a lot on course golf. And sometimes I would go to the range just because I could say, yes, I've went to the range and I hit a bucket. It's like a mental thing that I did. But did I achieve anything in that 30 minutes, an hour and a half? And no, I didn't. And I wasted time, money, because I didn't have a purpose. Also when you're on tour, you can hit the shots that you want to. But getting that mental perspective of, I'm achieving something. You have your list, and this is what I need to work on to improve, to get 1% better every day, type of a thing, which is crucial. I think also from a consumer point of view, and we've chatted about this before, is you could have clubs that's been passed down to you, or you've purchased, that is terrible for you. And it's not going to do any results on the golf course, on the range for you, because it's actually not set up for you. Because like we've discussed, people have different
body movements, length, strengths.
Different physical capabilities. And you can get it set up according to that.
Can I ask you this question? I was asked this week, about the a good friend of mine asked me, he's a 22 handicap, and he goes, I told him I'm coming up to get fit and see if everything is still in fine working order and if my swing has changed in the last year or 2 years now. And he goes, well, and I said, and he just bought two drivers, one for you and one in another place, but just went to a shop and bought it and didn't get fit. And I said, you are wasting your money. Why would you ever pay that amount of money for, and it's expensive to get those clubs. And they, the, the golf shop at a special, and he says, well, at 22 handicap, I feel embarrassed to get a fitting. Is that, when is a fitting working, or what handicap fits into
it's actually,
that?
It's actually so funny. So I worked this weekend at our Copperleaf shop, and my first fitting of the day rocks up. Comes with a M2 driver, which was actually a bloody good driver back in the time. And it's still a good driver. And I said, what are you here for today? He said, yeah, I've got this driver. It's my friend's. I'm probably going to buy it. So I just want to check it and see, you know, if it's good for me, what adjustments I need to do. So I'm fitting him and I'm fitting him. And it's got the wrong degree, the wrong flex, and the wrong weight. Everything's off. Okay, now there's nothing I can do. I can loft the driver up from 9 degree to 11 degree,
yeah,
and I can change a shaft, but the profile of the head and what he needs was not right. And he only started golf again now recently.
Yeah,
he didn't play for like 10 years. Yeah. So it was a difficult fit. I'm going to tell you that, you know. And I said to him, listen, I'm going to give you option A and option B. I tried my best to get that driver to work with different shafts and different settings, and it was much of a muchness. Then I said, okay, I'm going to fit you into something. If you have the budget or not, that's fine. We'll talk about it. And I completely fitted him into a opposite spec. I put a lady shaft in with a 12-degree head, draw bias, 40-gram ladies flex. And he hit it unbelievably. Like, listen, he was like half shanking the bloody thing. Yeah. Couldn't get it straight. No matter where he aims. And just by having that knowledge of putting the clubs together based on his miss and what he needed, yeah, he hit it straight. He's like, honestly, when I got here today, I didn't think a golf club could change my game this much. Even went back to his wife, because he obviously had to,
yeah,
you
know, get the approval.
Minister of Finance and whatnot, yeah, and sort it out. And he came back and he paid, and he's like, Arthur, I'm a believer now, because I promise you his ability was not even a 36 handicap. You know, yeah, he's starting. So there is no, to answer your question, there is no, listen, I need to be a scratch golfer or a single figure to get fitted. You can be any individual with any handicap as long as you can hit the ball. Then I've got, yeah, something to work with. So if you have the ability to hit the ball up in the air and hit it forward, we've got, yeah, something to work on. So it's crucial. You'll actually see more of a difference with an average golfer than a scratch golfer. The scratch golfer's got the ability to manipulate. Yeah. Like, you can give me a regular shaft, a lady shaft. After two shots, I know how I need to manipulate, yeah, the golf club. So it's crucial from the average consumer or the average golfer that they need it the most. Because if you fine-tune their game and make the dispersion tighter, their distance more accurate, you can actually improve and move forward in the game and make it more enjoyable, you know? So it's crazy.
You always fit with purpose.
Correct.
You always do.
Correct.
And the idea, Scott, was the perception is that it's expensive. There's no difference in cost going to Arthur and getting fitted than going to a big store and buying stock. Because they negotiate in prices. They negotiate in volumes.
For me also, it's not about going to Arthur and getting fitted.
Yeah.
It's the consumer buying the right product for that person, you know. My parents are Afrikaans, and they're going to hate me when they watch this. Some Afrikaans is not great, but what is that saying?
Goedkoop is dierkoop.
And that's the best example, maybe, I hope it, yeah, wasn't in his case, your friend, but that is the best example. Get it right once. It's going to last you a long time. Yeah. You're enjoying the golf equipment that you have. You know what you can do, and get it sorted, you know.
I've got a question on that. Every how many years do you change equipment, like driver or irons or wedges?
It's wedges is different.
Yeah,
wedges and irons is a bit different. I think wedges you would use the most, obviously based on grooves.
Yeah.
So however long the grooves last, you would have to upgrade your wedges. Irons and
drivers. Is that pretty much a year or two, or every 2-3 years?
It depends per golfer on how much you practice and play. Just hitting balls, yeah, okay, all the time on the range versus, yeah, you know, hitting it 15 times around is different. But you just keep an eye on your grooves. Another thing that people think, golf shafts get pup over time. You know, let's say you have an extra stiff and it's 10 years old. It doesn't. The shaft qualities these days, it keeps the flex, it keeps the stiffness. So to answer your question, I think it's more of a personal preference.
Okay.
Sometimes guys buy it because the new one's out and they just list to buy it. Other guys keep it for a long time because they enjoy what they're playing and they'll play with it until it either the head cracks or the grooves are finished in your iron. So it's more of a personal preference. The one thing that people need to do if they do play a lot or they don't, you know, whether you play every other weekend or you play once a month, there is a period where you need to check your lie angles, you know, because you're hitting balls and golf clubs have got a muscle memory. So you can bet it up or down and eventually over time from hitting it and whatnot, it's going to go back to the muscle memory, to the standard lie angle. Okay. So that is also crucial to check. Not necessarily means you need to change your clubs, but just keep, it's like going and getting new tires for your golf, for your car, or checking your alignment. Those small things you can check frequently, six months to two years. And then, go hit the clubs until they murtu and then buy new ones. You know, so it's different. It's different.
Arthur, thank you very much. And Skylar, thank you so much for sitting here with us. I hope that we impress you enough. Plus, we do the show enough justice that we can invite you up again to come and speak to us again, because I think there's still a lot for us to go into. And I, you know, wanted to talk, I liked where you were going with some of the questions on to Arthur. And I just want to say, as an ending part from my side, we really appreciate everything you do for sport in South Africa. Thank you for being an incredible example as a man for a lot of men to look up to. And thank you for not just talking about it, but also walking the walk. I certainly know, Skylar, not perfect. We all are just human and have our own little nitties and gritties that we are resolving. But from an outsider perspective and somebody that's also dealt with you for a while over time, and the first time I met you, you greeted every waiter and waitress at the restaurant we went into. You did exactly the same today. Mm. Every staff member in this office got a hug.
How many times have you got COVID? Because I'm sure you must have.
That's the funny thing. I only got COVID this year.
And
very mild symptoms. Like, it was literally like a cough. And Gideon, a friend, my boss, but a friend firstly, said, listen, Skylar, just go check yourself out. I'm just having it like that. And I never get headaches, and I had a headache, and he went for a test, and I'm like, okay, positive.
Oh, my God. Because
the way that Skulk goes, he just hugs everyone.
And
in everyone's faces, and that's, I respect that a lot about you. You're very consistent, and you're a great guy, whether you're on the rugby pitch or at a restaurant or coming to my store. Always consistent, always walking around with a smile on your face. I think you're a great leader. And from my side, thank you for coming to see me this afternoon, trusting me with your club fitting and listening to me talk cuck for so long and trying to explain everything, why I'm doing it, and giving us the time, your time, to be here and have a chat with us. I think it was a fantastic day.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Thanks, lots of love. Skylar. Thank you for the invite. And may this show go from strength to strength, and hopefully I'll get another invite someday.
Yes. Thank you. Next time you'll play, Skylar.
next time we'll find out what his handicap is.
Yeah.
For the next show.
Well, next time on the show, I will give you information how I've taken the money of these two gents.
I look forward to that update.
On the next episode of The Human Golf Show.
For me, I like being out of my comfort zone. I love it. Absolutely love it. And it's not that I'm saying I don't like being in my comfort zone. Yes, sometimes I do not want to wake up in the morning. Yes, I do not want to go to the golf course now. I do not want to go and practice. Although it happens a lot.
Yeah.
But I love being out of my comfort zone because I love to test myself. And that's essentially where it comes down to.